KPCW News Time is 8:06. You're listening to the Local News Hour. Well, yesterday I was able to play a little golf with my shirt sleeves. Nate, I don't think I'm going to get to be able to do that this weekend. What do you think?
This weekend it's actually turning nice again, but yeah, it's a little chilly out there this morning. Temperatures are very cold, in fact. We're highs, though, today, rebounding with high pressure building back in. Should see plenty of sunshine, about 63. So that sounds pretty nice if you wait till the early afternoon when temperatures rebound. Overnight lows, not as cold into the weekend, near 40 degrees into Saturday morning, 67 for the high tomorrow. We do have some bigger changes, though, next week. So, yeah, get your golf game in this weekend if that's something you're itching to do. 66 by Sunday. We start to drop in temperatures Monday, a high of just 57 for Park City. A front moving in Monday night into Tuesday. We'll bring a chance of snow to Park City. Temperatures drop to 30 degrees on Tuesday morning with a high of just 38 on Tuesday afternoon. So snow showers off and on throughout the day Tuesday with a storm system moving through. Lingering moisture into Wednesday, partly cloudy skies, mainly showers expected in the morning with overnight lows in the mid-20s. Should see some drier conditions for Halloween, although it's a little tricky. There's storms still showing up for sometime late Thursday night into Friday morning. So timing on it could be key, of course, for trick-or-treaters on Thursday, showing still about a 20% chance of a shower Halloween night. Highs near 42 on Thursday with partly cloudy skies. Heber looking at 68 today, 72 tomorrow. Temperatures near 70 on Sunday. Lots of sunshine today into tomorrow, but partly cloudy skies on Sunday ahead of the storm system moving in Monday. Temperatures will be in the mid-30s as we get into early next week with highs near 63 on Monday. Chance of showers late in the day. Rain and snow showers on Tuesday. Overnight lows in the upper 20s with mid-40s for highs Tuesday afternoon. Chance of moisture lingers into Wednesday before it clears out, mainly in the morning, with highs in the mid-40s again Wednesday afternoon and back to 50 on Halloween. That's after overnight lows are near 20 degrees, though, to kick off Thursday. And that small chance of a shower still lingers Thursday. It's looking like better chances for Friday. Hopefully that pattern holds and stays dry for much of Halloween.
Nate, it's the ski resorts are hoping to open, you know, third week in November. Obviously, yeah, that takes a bit of cold weather. What are we looking at in the bigger picture? Do you think we're going to see the kind of cold weather that we're going to need for them to be able to make snow and open?
You know, the pattern looks more progressive as we into at least the 6 to 10 day outlook. If we look out the next 2 weeks, it's looking like we should have near normal temperatures, which is good news, at least, right? So typically we're cooler this time of year. Unfortunately, the storm systems that we're tracking, at least the next two on the horizon, aren't packing a lot of moisture with it. But again, yeah, we'll kind of have to wait and see how mid to end of October is shaping up with the models. Basically, 2 weeks out is about as far out as they look. Mm-hmm. Anything beyond that, we talk about Climate Prediction Center and their predictions that they're putting out. They are anticipating kind of an equal chances for precipitation and for temperatures to be near normal for much of the state as we head into the winter season. But right now, October's not looking super wet. There's no forcing, I guess, either way. It's kind of looking like it could be pretty average at this point.
Okay, Nate Larson with ABC4. I'm going to be asking you that question every week from now on. Thanks,
perfect.
Nate. Thanks, Nate.
Let's do it. All right, see ya.
You're listening to the Local News Hour. Coming up, we're going to have an interview that Parker Malatested recorded with Paralympic wheelchair basketball player Ali Ibanez. Then I'll be joined in the studio by Ed Parisian with a debrief from last night's city council meeting. We'll finish our hour with our monthly chat with Lauren Gustis, the executive editor of the Salt Lake Tribune. Please stay tuned. In the past year, the number of Wasatch County residents seeking services from Peace House has more than doubled. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports.
Rates of domestic violence and sexual assault are notoriously difficult to measure, but research from the Utah Department of Health has shown almost 1 in 5 women and about 1 in 10 men in Utah experience intimate partner violence. More than 170 people from Wasatch County turned to Peace House for resources between July 2023 and June 2024. That's more than 2.5 times higher than the previous year when the organization served 67 Wasatch County locals. Peace House Executive Director Kendra Wyckoff attributes the dramatic increase in part to the county's rapid growth.
Wasatch County in particular has really grown considerably over the last 3-4 years. And unfortunately, you know, as your community grows, sometimes some of the challenges that your community faces also grow. And domestic violence can be one of those challenges.
In fact, a report by the Utah Women and Leadership Project from 2023 shows the number of domestic violence incidents reported to law enforcement in Wasatch County more than tripled in 2020 and 2021. Wyckoff says Peace House provided over 700 nights of safety to Wasatch County families in its emergency shelter last year.
With emergency shelter, individuals are not just receiving that safe housing, they're receiving all of those wraparound support services that we also have on our campus. And those things include like legal advocacy, case management services, which is really a specialized advocate who walks that family through understanding what their safety needs are, what resources they might need. They might need housing, health care, mental health counseling, financial assistance.
There's also a children's services program to help parents with child care and give kids activities and community to be part of while they're staying in emergency shelter. There's no shelter within Wasatch County for domestic violence survivors. Wyckoff says survivors can find help at Peace House in neighboring Summit County or at the Refuge in Utah County.
We are both in adjacent counties. We recognize the importance of collaborating in that community to ensure that any individual has an opportunity to receive the support that they need at which agency works best for them.
Advocates from the Refuge are available to support survivors of sexual assault at the Heber Valley Hospital. And Wyckoff says Peace House is working to spread awareness of its services in Wasatch County, including advocates at the library, flyers posted in local businesses, and phone number tear-off sheets in public restrooms, so it's easier to access support. And this month, the organization held its annual Be the Light event in Heber City Park for Domestic Violence Awareness Month.
The most important thing that we can do as an individual is to believe a survivor and listen to them, and then get them connected to services in our community.
If you've experienced domestic violence or sexual assault, help is available. Peace House's 24-hour hotline can be reached at 800-647-9161. The Refuge's domestic violence hotline is 801-377-5500. Visit kpcw.org for those resources. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
So Basin Recreation is conducting a trail speed study to track how fast e-bikes are in fact traveling on local trails. KPCW's Christine Weller has more.
The Snyderville Basin Recreation Special Service District adopted the same speed limits and e-bike rules as Park City in July. Now, major bike paths in the Park City area, such as the Rail Trail, have speed limits of 15 miles per hour. However, Basin Recreation Executive Director Dana Jones said after hearing repeated concerns about enforcement, the organization is conducting a study to see if riders are speeding on trails. Speed signs have been placed on trails around Willow Creek Park and on the Millennium Trail to record speed data as riders pedal by.
The vast majority of people that are on these trails and going past these speed signs and the data that we're getting are within the speed limit.
Jones said even on downhill slopes, riders are traveling within the speed limit most of the time. However, many pedestrians still feel e-bikes are going too fast. Jones said rangers are working to educate riders.
The rangers talk to hundreds of people, you know, every week, just to let people know the perception is that you're going too fast. So when you're going by somebody, give them plenty of room. You might slow down a little bit and just basically be kind out there on the trails.
Jones said Basin Recreation will continue looking at the data to see if there are trail spots needing extra rangers to enforce the limit. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Well, KPCW's Parker Malatesta sat down with Paralympian Ali Ibanez to talk about the 2024 Paralympics. Ibanez won a silver medal in Paris, competing for the U.S. women's wheelchair basketball team. Here's that interview.
I'm KPCW's Parker Malatesta. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. And in studio with me today, I've got Ali Ibanez. She's a Paralympian on the women's wheelchair basketball team who just competed in Paris this summer. How's it going today, Ali?
It's going good. It's a little cold outside.
Yeah, it's freezed up a bit since the summer. Well, you just competed in Paris, and you all took home the silver medal. But this was your second Paralympic Games?
Yeah, second Paralympic Games. My first Paralympic Games was in Tokyo 2020, but they did it in 2021 just because of COVID.
Mm-hmm. And you're originally from where, in the Salt Lake Valley, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Where at?
Murray?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and so how'd you find your way to wheelchair basketball?
It was kind of just like a coincidence, I guess. My older sister was babysitting for a family, and they had gone to like the elementary school playgrounds to like play a little bit, and she ended up calling my mom, and there was a Wheelchair basketball team practicing on the outdoor courts. So we went over, and then I started playing with them like the next day, I think.
Yeah. Have you ever played basketball?
Nope. I think before basketball, I didn't really have any experience with like adaptive sports. I just kind of tried to tack my way in with like my siblings and like their sports and stuff. But
yeah. Do you mind talking a bit about your condition?
So I have arthrogryposis. It's a congenital disability. So it affects like my, I have like contractures in my lower extremities, so I can't really stand up or anything. But other than that.
Yeah. So where did it take, you know, were introduced to it. When did it take a more serious turn into, you know, you really wanted to compete?
I think it was my junior year in high school. I had been practicing with the, like that junior varsity team since 2013, so I think I was about 4 years into playing with the team, and I was really blessed to have like a set of coaches that kind of knew more about the wheelchair basketball community and the different levels of play within it. So we go through the National Wheelchair Basketball Association. It's similar to like NCAA stuff. And I think, yeah, my junior year, my coach had told me and one of the other girls on the team that, like, he thought we should try out for the national team. And I ended up not going. It's like you have to fly to Colorado Springs for the tryouts at the USOPC. But I just couldn't afford it at that point. So I tried out the next year, my senior year, in that January, and then made the team after the second round of selections, which I think was like that February. But yeah, so it was kind of just something like my coaches knew about and were really like involved with that got me into the national team level stuff.
Yeah, and then I read you attended University of Illinois at Champaign. I know that's a, you know, big basketball legacy there. What was your time like there?
It was pretty good. Like I said, I was really blessed to have like a good set of teammates, really good coach, Stephanie Wheeler. She's kind of an icon in the world of wheelchair basketball. Like, she's done a lot to like progress the like adaptive athletics kind of movement, really advocating for her athletes and stuff like that. And then, I don't know, just the legacy from the U of I.
Yeah.
You have handfuls and handfuls of athletes that are alum from there that have moved on to Paralympics for either representing Team USA or like Team Canada, stuff like that.
Yeah, and your first Paralympics was that Tokyo, right? What was that like? I assume that was, you know, pandemic time. I mean, what was that first experience like for you?
It was a lot of waiting, I think. Like, we were kind of expecting to go like end of that summer. And then when COVID happened, we were all kind of just holding our breath, I think. I guess it was good for me. I broke my hand in that, like, December right before COVID. So I had a little bit of time to, like, heal up and come back better than I was before that. But the games were, I mean, it was my first games, and I thought it was crazy. But we had a couple of veterans on the team that were like, if you guys are losing your mind about this, like, just wait until there's no COVID and you're back here and it's going to be crazier than you think it is. And I was like, okay, that's cool. But I don't know. It was kind of a surreal thing to like be at my first games. Like, I was one of the rookies on the team, but it was good having, like, we had a pretty good balance of rookies and veterans.
And how did you all finish in those games?
We finished with bronze, which I think was a little bit more than we expected to finish. We had a really, really young group of girls. And I think new, like, not young, I guess, but like a new coaching squad.
Yeah.
As opposed to like the prior Paralympic Games, which was coached by Steph Wheeler, who was my coach at the U of I.
Yeah, very cool. Well, and then, so, you know, a bit of an upgrade, taking home the silver, earlier this summer. And, you know, walk me through the games this year. You all start with qualifying round and then it goes to elimination?
Yeah, we start with pool play and then we get into quarter semis, just like you typically would with other stand-up teams.
Yeah, what would you say your all's expectation was coming into the games?
I think we had really like high expectations overall. We did play in a set of like friendlies games over the summer. We flew all the way to China for them, which was a long trip. But the Netherlands were there. They ended up winning gold at this last games. But we were down one player. One of our players plays overseas in Spain, like professionally, so she wasn't able to come to those friendlies. But I mean, we kind of kicked the Netherlands' ass when we were there. So I think we were really expecting, like, okay, when we're completely 12 deep, when we have our complete roster, like, we're going to be better than we were. But I think we just fell short in some areas. And the Netherlands is a really good team and they have really, like, excellent, respectable players. So it was a little unfortunate, but we finished better than we did last time. So next time we'll get gold.
Totally. Where do you fit in terms of your player profile? I mean, are you a shooter? Are you defense first? Where do you line up?
I'm not really sure. I'd like to say my specialties more on like the defensive side. Most of our midpoint players. So the difference between like wheelchair basketball and like stand-up basketball is we don't really have like set positions like stand-up does. We don't really have specified like point guards or post players or whatever. It's mostly based on height and classification, which is based on your ability. So I'm a mid-pointer. My classification's 2-5, which means I have like limited core function as opposed to a minimal disability player, which would be like a 4-5. And I'm horrible with like the technical stuff with the basketball, but I think it's 14 points that are allocated that you can have on court at a time. So like most of our midpointers, I guess, are kind of lie in. I'm a weird player because I am not like really that much of a shooter. I'm mostly like picking for like my other bigs or setting a screen for like the other midpointers who are typically shooters. Like you have Becca Murray and Lindsay Zerbrug and they're amazing shooters about 90% of the time. And then the other 10%, they're amazing defensive players. So my specialty is defense.
Yeah. And just talking more about the differences in terms of tactics, you know, I think most people may be aware of pick and roll and how that's used in offense. I mean, you all are utilizing picks as well pretty consistently.
Yeah, it looks a little bit different, but same concepts kind of apply.
Yeah, and then what about on defense? I mean, is that a zone approach at all or man-to-man?
It varies, I guess. Like, we do the same things, like, translate from, like, stand-up. Like, you can do pressure defense, zone defense. I think the one we utilized most was, like, our pressure defense with our faster, like,
full court press.
Yeah, those are really fun. I enjoy those. I like doing the aggressive defense. I mean, it's relatively the same thing as stand-up, just looks a little bit different.
And I was curious too, you know, like there's just been like this whole three-point revolution obviously, and just like more emphasis on that shot selection in particular. I mean, has that translated into wheelchair basketball?
I would definitely say for like the men's side. I think the women's side of, you know, this level is like we're wanting those easy shots, which like you're gonna get if you use your like fundamentals the right way, I guess. I don't know. Like, I don't feel like our team really takes the three-pointers. I mean, Becca Murray and Lindsay are like mid-pointers that are amazing shooters. Like, that shot's open for them all day, but I think we like working together a little bit more than just...
Totally. It's more fun to watch when it's really, you know, a lot of good passing. Just curious too, kind of the first non-COVID games, I mean, outside of the sporting events, what was your experience in Paris like?
It was crazy. You could hardly like hear yourself speak when you were in a gym. It was just roaring. And like, France put on a really great show for the games. You know, they were bringing in like tons and tons of fans to the arena. Like all the tickets were sold out, which was obviously like completely different from Tokyo, where you could drop a pin and hear it from all the way across the gym.
Sure.
Yeah, I don't know. It was just kind of like shocking a little bit.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, my entire life playing basketball, like, you don't get a lot of fans. But I think, I don't know, where, like, the WNBA was, like, maybe 5 years ago, 10 years ago, is kind of where the Paralympic movement is at right now.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping by the time, like, LA comes around that we're at that same level of, like, exposure and inclusivity.
Yeah, and what do you maybe think are some, you know, key things to get there? Because, I mean, you mentioned the WNBA, you know, obviously Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese, and like they've blown that up into this whole other stratosphere now. I mean, how do you feel like wheelchair basketball could do the same thing?
I mean, I think it's like we have those kind of like pivotal individuals that are able to
the star
like,
power.
Yeah. Like push the movement a little bit more. But I mean, outside of like wheelchair basketball too, like you have Chuck Aoki from men's wheelchair rugby that's doing a really good job with like his social media.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's, I don't know, there's just a handful of like athletes that are really pushing for like this exposure, and they're doing a really good job and like going about a good way with it. So I think it's just giving more opportunities for these sports to be on the same level of platforms as like our stand-up counterparts.
Totally. And outside of the Paralympics, I mean, what chances do you have to play competitively? What does that look like?
Yeah, so now that I'm graduated from the University of Illinois, so I can't play collegiately anymore, but I'm playing with a D1 team in Utah. So it's the Wheeling Jazz.
Cool.
We practice in like the Sandy area. I think it's the Sandy area. It's been a minute since I've been here. But they travel, I think, like 1 to 2 times a month.
Mm-hmm.
Our season just started. And then I'm also playing in Canada for a couple tournaments. I have one of my roommates from college is Canadian and plays up there. So they've just asked to fly me in for a couple tournaments.
Yeah.
To use some low pointers that are good with the defense. But, yeah. And then, I mean, there's other opportunities. Like, there's a women's division with the NWBA. You have collegiate divisions, junior divisions, D1, D2, D3. And then, obviously, you can play competitively, or not competitively, professionally over in like overseas.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of Euro leagues that you can play for, but you gotta be invited. So I don't know, there's a lot of opportunities.
Yeah.
But there's just, it's a little bit more difficult with adaptive sports just because it doesn't get the same funding as like your typical stand-up club team sports, or
totally
like your there's not a university team here. Mm-hmm. Which like I think we're trying to get, but I mean obviously you need funding and stuff for that. But yeah, there's a lot of opportunities.
Yeah.
It's just knowing where to find them.
Totally. And so your eyes are set on LA 28?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think a lot of the girls from this squad are planning on LA. I know one of our girls retired, but she's got a whole life outside of basketball, so it's understandable.
But hopefully bring in some veterans back. I'll have a good experienced squad ready for 2028.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anything you specifically are trying to work on in your game?
I don't know. I feel like just keep kind of honing my skills defensively, getting better on the offensive stuff, which I hate, but I'm good working for other people. I'm not good working for myself.
Yeah, good team player.
Yeah.
Well, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. I appreciate you coming in studio. And anything else you want to mention?
Not that I can think of.
Totally cool. We've been speaking with Ali Ibanez, Paralympian, who competed in the 2024 Paralympics in Paris for the women's wheelchair basketball team.
Here in in the studio with me is Ed Parisian, Park City Council member. He's going to talk to us about last night's Park City Council meeting, which I understand was a little unusual in that there were not a lot of people physically present for the meeting.
Like nobody?
There was nobody?
There was zero. We had a few staff in the back, but zero residents, nobody on Zoom that called. We had zero public comments. That's a good, that moves it along.
Well, I guess it is shoulder season here in Park City, and,
right?
And things are quiet. You did hear a couple of significant reports last night. One of them dealt with the Kimball Arts Festival. Can you share a little bit about what you learned and what you think for the future of the Kimball Arts Festival is?
Well, we learned they're still going strong. It's a great thing for the city. We love it. I love going. They just went through the numbers. Is how much we generated, how many people. It was 29,000 people came over the three-day event. So I think it was just about even with last year, give or take.
Now, I understand one issue that did come up deals with the revenue associated with the booths that cannot be built because of patios, restaurant
right.
patios,
the
and
decks.
And the decks. Can you explain what that was about and was there a resolution to that question?
Well, it goes way back because they had certain footprint that they could only be within the Arts Fest. And then as the restaurants put out food decks over the years, it ate into the footprint. So basically we were trying to compensate the Arts Fest for lost revenue from the booths, like you said, that couldn't be put in.
You know, it's an interesting concept. It's almost like the Arts Fest, and everybody's treating it like they had an entitlement to all that space, and that by putting the decks on, you've taken something away
right.
that they had a property interest in. It's just an interesting way of looking at
it. Isn't it?
But,
they only have certain footprints.
Right.
And they're a nonprofit. They need to make money on this thing, so I get it. Just try to share again. We try to share space.
Was there also a change in the fee that they pay for city services? I know that was on the agenda.
Well,
did I misunderstand?
Yeah.
Which I probably did.
There was a deal. It was $12,000 worth of, so it was $1,500. They valued each deck at $1,500. There were eight decks. So it was $12,000 that they were losing. And so they paid us $10,000 for services. We were paying them $12,000. We kind of
offset
each other. Like, all right, you don't pay the $10,000. We don't pay the $12,000, we're even, we're good.
Okay.
So that's how it worked out. I think that's simpler that way.
And I take it as far as everybody's concerned, the Arts Fest is here to stay, at least for the time
being.
Oh,
I hope so.
Okay.
I hope Kimball's here to stay. We'll get him a nice piece of land over there.
Well, that takes us to a natural segue to the small business area, the Bonanza small area. Talk to us
the
about
village.
Talk to us about what the status of that is. The RFP, there's an RFP out on the street for the, let me get,
right.
is the term right, the Bonanza small area plan?
I call it Bonanza Village.
Okay, we'll call it Bonanza
Just
Village.
Just to, differentiate it from the greater Bonanza Park.
Okay, so where does that stand?
Right. Well, we worked hard on it all summer, and we get the RFP out in August. It's due, I think response is due November 5th, and we're marketing it heavily. We want international, we want somebody this is a prime spot, in a big tourist town. So we want somebody with some vision, some resources, a little imagination here to come in and do this thing like up really good.
Now, in this particular RFP process, are there questions being asked by the potential bidders during this period, or do they just have to submit something?
They can ask. I think that window is closed
okay.
to ask questions. I think up front you can ask a few questions, but after a while I think you're not allowed to.
Do you have any...
But you can look at the questions that were asked.
Are those posted?
And the answers that are posted, okay. right.
Do you have any sense as to how many responses you might get based on the questions and the other sort of interest you've heard expressed?
No, I have not. I hope a bunch. I think we got three... I don't even know because they never told us. Responses to the RSOQ, which we just said, no, we shouldn't have done that. So we're not, we, those responses went out the window, and we started from scratch again.
Okay, so
with the RFP.
Okay, so the RSOQ responses were not being used as a window or a vehicle by which you had to get through in order to do the RFP.
Right.
Anybody can bid the RFP.
Right, everybody.
Okay.
And hopefully a bunch.
Now, talk a little bit about the process. Once those RFP responses are back on the 5th, what's the process going to be to evaluate and determine a winner?
Well, they get graded. There's a grading formula. It's actually in the RFP.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be a committee. Who knows what's going to... I don't even know. They don't let me be on it. I know that.
And is there a target for the award? A target date?
I think we're talking maybe January, February. I'm not sure. It's going to be a couple months to get... Well, depending on how many people we get, firms we get responding... I guess that'll determine. I've never been through this process, mm-hmm. so I just help get the RFP out, and then they do their thing.
Okay. Council also heard a report on Silly Market. Was this year considered a success?
It was.
Mm-hmm.
Kate was on there. Kimberly was ducked in a little bit.
That was Kate McChesney and Kimberly...
Kim.
Okay. And they are both with the...
Yeah, of the Park Silly.
Of Park Silly,
Kate's
okay.
Kate's the... She's the main.
Okay.
Now.
Okay.
It was a success. We didn't get necessarily any of the metrics, but they had their 11 days, and they were very excited that they did pretty well.
Okay. And, I guess a little over a year ago, there was some controversy about what the future of the Silly Market would be.
Right.
And then this was the new contract. Was this the first year of the new contract?
I think it might have been.
Okay. And they...
5 years.
It's a 5-year contract. Okay. And there are what... is there any issue regarding the number of days that the Silly Market will be allowed to operate?
I mean, they would always take more. They're not pushing for more. They've been great to work with. I mean, they're easygoing. They want to do this thing. I love working with those guys. So we brought it up last night. It's like, well, if you want some more dates, maybe we'll see down the road a year or two, and we'll kind of figure out.
One of the other issues, I believe, in the new contract related to noise between 10 and noon. And there were some issues about how loud the amplified music during those first 2 hours. I take it that, was there any report on whether that was adhered to? Was that a success?
The report said they had, zero complaints.
Okay.
So, I wouldn't know because I wasn't here at 10 in the morning. But I come to these shows after, and I know those all were within the... Nobody was complaining.
Now, Ed, how long have you been on council at this point?
10 years.
It's been a little less than a year, hasn't it?
10 months.
10 months,
actually, right.
Is the experience what you expected it to be?
And more.
Mm-hmm.
It's great. I love it. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have done it if I didn't know... It was going to be great. I'm so excited to represent the voice of the people. It's like I get chills sometimes when I come home after a meeting. I'm like, oh, we did good. You know, so it's been great. It's a lot, maybe a lot more work than I thought.
I was going to ask you. Does it take more time than you expected?
Yeah. There's the ribbon cuttings and meeting with this and meeting with that. So the level behind this, you don't see all the behind-the-scenes stuff that we got to... that we do, you know, just meetings with this and meetings with that, and, you know, everybody wants a little piece of you, and I love it, because I love people, so to be, you know, at some point, though, you can't do everything,
yeah.
So I have to skip maybe a ribbon cutting, but tomorrow morning, I'm going to emcee the Pies and Lines over at the Book Festival at the library. So just little things like that, you know, eat into your lack of book reading time.
Okay. We've been speaking with Ed Prisian of the Park City Council. Thanks for joining us this morning, Ed.
All right. Oh, Roger, can I say one
Absolutely.
Thing?
Absolutely.
Mystery in the Stacks tonight.
Mystery
if you're
in the stacks
looking
tonight,
for please. Something to do, this could be fun. It's 6 o'clock to 7:30 tonight at the library. We're going to do a little Mystery in the Stacks. People are going to dress up as little people are going to try to figure it's like a whodunit. It should be kind of fun.
We'll feature our very own John Burdick, among others, in the improv group.
Oh, sure.
John's in it. Katrina Comack's in it.
Katrina, of course.
There we go.
Got to get those guys.
All right.
That's great. We get two of them per area, the Follies and that. So now I'm even looking forward to it more.
All right. Thanks for spending time with us.
Thanks, Roger. Appreciate it.
We'll be right back after this. Boulder, Colorado, and Cincinnati, Ohio are the two cities trying to steal the Sundance Film Festival away from Utah. Parker Malatesta spoke with locals about what they have to offer.
At first glance, the two cities seem like they couldn't be more different. One sits on the banks of the Ohio River, the other tucked into the foothills of the Rocky Mountains. One is an outdoor destination, the other is home to some of the biggest corporations in the U.S. What they have in common, though, is a desire to make the legendary Sundance Film Festival a cornerstone of their growing arts and culture scenes, including independent film. And their proposals have piqued considerable interest from festival organizers as they consider a move out of Utah, its home for 40 years. Kelly Sears is a filmmaker and associate professor at CU Boulder's Cinema Studies Department.
I think something that Boulder uniquely offers is that there is a really committed cinema audience here. The audience here really is so curious about films they don't know and are open to like so many forms of cinematic expression here. And I think that that's something that has been cultivated over decades and decades here that continues to grow.
Allison West is the founder of the Sindependent Film Festival, a local annual event showcasing the work of over 100 artists that began in Cincinnati in 2018.
The differentiator is the people. The people here live wonderful, vibrant lives full of interesting arts experiences that come and go. And they are basically like some of the best human beings I've ever met in all of my travels and all of my adventures.
In April, the Sundance Film Festival announced it would explore host locations outside of Park City due to affordability concerns and to be more accessible to audiences. To keep the festival in Utah, Park City has partnered with Salt Lake City to present a dual bid. Under their plan, more Sundance screenings and events would occur in Salt Lake as compared with the existing event footprint. Along with Utah's bid, Sundance recently named Boulder and Cincinnati as the two other finalists. A final decision about the 10-year contract, which would begin in 2027, is expected after the January festival next year. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Well, once a month, we get to chat with Lauren Gustis, the executive editor of the Salt Lake Tribune, about all the things that are going on here in Utah. Morning, Lauren.
Hi, Roger. How are you?
Excellent. It's a little bit chilly, but they tell us it's going to warm up. And, you know, the other thing that's warming up, of course, is this election, which is very much in the news. The Tribune ran an interesting story on fundraising here in Utah. Can you share a little bit about it?
Yeah, so as you and your listeners probably know, Roger, there's no way that Harris wins in Utah.
You think?
Harris is the Democratic nominee for president, and Donald Trump is the Republican nominee, as folks know. However, Harris is winning in one category, and that is in fundraising. So here in Utah, the Harris campaign has raised about $2.5 million. Trump has raised just over $1 million. That's a departure from even where we were with Joe Biden and Donald Trump running against each other in terms of the money that was coming in for the Democratic and Republican national elections. That money probably won't be spent in Utah, but it is interesting to see the support that Harris has among some of the higher dollar donors in Utah.
And do you think that's a statement about these people, the people who are interested in supporting Harris in Utah, know that their votes don't matter that much, and this is probably the only way they can actually try to express their feelings in this election as a practical matter?
Yeah, that's a really fair point. The Harris campaign has been up your way to Summit County a number of times, and there are so many people who are deeply engaged. But as you said, Roger, do know that, you know, their vote will not matter in Utah's electoral count, which is very likely to go to Trump.
Now, it's interesting that the fundraising numbers you just gave, because I believe Vice President Harris was here right after the debate before she became the nominee. I don't think she's been here since then. But Donald Trump did make an appearance, I believe, at the Salt Lake Airport in the interim, didn't he?
He did, yep. He stopped in and met with a number of officials, public officials, elected officials here in Utah, some dignitaries. But Harris's campaign has sent other constituents to Utah. So you're seeing, you know, members of the Walz, group come out, others who are maybe lesser known. I'm sure there's bigger money elsewhere for the Harris campaign to go get, right? But they have sent some intermediaries, if you will. And then, yes, Trump arrived. He was refueling the plane, spent some time here with folks, did not leave the airport, but it was an official campaign stop, yes, for fundraising purposes.
Okay. There are a number of proposed constitutional amendments on the ballot, but some of them won't be counted. Can you sort of just remind viewers of how that's going to work? And does it really matter what they put in the box?
That's a good question, Roger, and I suppose it depends on your opinion. But there are four proposed changes to the Utah Constitution on the ballot. Only two of them will be counted and made public. However, there are folks who believe that the other two may surface, even though the Supreme Court has ruled that they are null and void. And so you can vote. You don't have to vote. You can fill in the bubble. You cannot fill in the bubble. Utah's election office, which is, you know, essentially the office of the lieutenant governor, says that these votes will not be counted. But you can fill in the bubble and tell, you know, someone out there who may or may not see this result, what you think of Amendments A and D. And Amendments A and D are the ones that have been nullified by state courts because lawmakers crafted language that was misleading. So Amendment D has to do with initiatives approved by the people and letting the legislature have a little bit more power over what happens to those initiatives after they're approved. Amendment A, also voided by the courts, would remove from the Constitution the requirement that all funds raised from state income tax go to education and services for the disabled. So both of those are on your ballot, but they won't be counted. Now, they could be made public, even though they're not supposed to be in some way, shape, or form. And so there are some folks out there who are saying, well, still vote no or still vote yes if you support them or if you don't, so that, you know, if and when that material is ever made public, you know, it will reflect your wishes. Now, I will tell you, Roger, I think that it's likely that at least D comes back in some way, shape, or form in the next couple of years. Not sure about A. And then there's two more, B and C. Amendment B is related to school funding as well. It would raise from 4%, which is where we currently are now, to 5%, the amount that can be drawn from the state's land trust accounts to benefit public schools, right? So it's essentially allocating more money to public schools from the sale or the benefit of the public lands that the state owns and is, you know, mandated to find a return on investment for schools for. And then Amendment C is a move right into the Utah Constitution, a requirement that all county sheriffs across the state be elected. Now, you may be wondering, don't I vote for my county sheriff? Yes, you do. Amendment C will do is codify it in the Constitution that they must be elected. There's been a fair bit of chatter on whether this amendment is quote unquote good or bad for Utah. It gives sheriffs more certainty with respect to their job. It does also appear to align with the constitutional sheriffs movement that submits or posits that local elected sheriffs are the supreme law enforcement officer in every county, superior to federal law and federal agencies. And you might be able to infer where that's going as you look at the public lands discussions that have unfolded here in Utah over the course of the last several years.
You think about it, you fill out a ballot. When we say it won't be counted, are they actually going to program the computers that count the ballots not to look at that bubble? In which case, there would never be information to be released.
Fair. Thank you. Yeah, good question. Thanks for asking for that clarification. Mm-hmm. They cannot reprogram the computers. They could not reprint the ballots. So it will be counted, won't be made public.
I wonder if that would be subject to freedom of information or GRAMA more specifically. I wonder if, you know, is it right. Secret for some reason?
Good question. Yeah. No, as we understand it, we would not be able to GRAMA or make a public records request for the results of the Amendment A and Amendment D votes.
Okay.
That would be counted by these ballot counting machines.
Because a lot of us are very curious. But anyway, I haven't seen a lot of yard signs relating to the Utah governor's race, but I did see yesterday in somebody's front yard, write-in Phil Lyman. How active is this write-in campaign, and what's going on with the litigation surrounding it?
Great question. So Spencer Cox is our incumbent. Phil Wyman challenged him in the Republican primary and lost, and has made a lot of challenges in the courts since that loss in the primary back in June. I'll tell you, Roger, I'm down in Moab for work today. The Tribune has a sister paper down here, the Moab Times Independent, which is a great paper. I encourage people to check it out, moabtimes.com. I was also down in St. George a couple of weeks ago. I've seen a fair number of write-in Lyman signs, and he's got a fair bit of support. Do we think it's enough to change the trajectory of the gubernatorial race? No, probably not. And I don't know what Lyman's thinking, but one could submit that he doesn't think so either. So he's trying to go through the courts. And just this week, he asked a last minute and unlikely attempt. He asked to have Governor Spencer Cox disqualified from the election, which is now just 2 weeks away. And he's saying that, you know, Cox should be disqualified because, you know, the Republican Party's internal rules trump Utah's election law, which is a claim that the courts had rejected previously. He's saying, you know, because he received more votes in the delegate space at the nominating convention, you know, that that supersedes, you know, signature gathering, which is another path to being elected here in Utah, or excuse me, to making the primary ballot. So anyhow, everybody views his challenge as a long shot. It's not, how do I want to say this? The Supreme Court isn't even mandated to pick it up, right, to rule on it. We've got, you know, how many days now until the election? Today's Friday, and we've got another week plus. It's very unlikely that Lyman's stance, which is that he's the legitimate GOP nominee for office, will stick with the courts if they even decide to hear it before the election.
Is there any polling that shows what kind of votes Lyman is likely to pull?
Sorry, could you repeat that, Roger? You just cut out for a minute.
Is there any polling surrounding Lyman's effort to write-in campaign?
Yes. And there are polls that have been done by Democratic challenger Brian King. There are polls that have been done by Spencer Cox. Both of those campaigns have shared their polling results with us. We haven't seen anything from the Lyman camp. He may have polls as well. But as you would imagine, the Cox and King polls show different numbers, right? Yes. I'm less inclined as the editor of a newspaper to engage in that kind of racehorse coverage, if you will. We try to talk a little bit more about the issues and certainly challenges like the one that Lyman made in courts week. Neither of the polls, I will say, even though the numbers are different, show that Lyman could disrupt or overtake either candidate in this race. And certainly in both polls, Cox does have a lead over King and over Lyman.
Again, probably not too surprising. I want to touch on a couple of education stories. Now, HB 84 was the bill that requires school districts to have armed guards at school. Where do things stand with respect to implementation? And more importantly, where do things stand with respect to funding by the states to cover those costs?
Gosh, yeah, Roger, they're having trouble paying for it.
I would
think
so.
The state initially allocated about $100 million to increase security in schools, and more specifically, they introduced, the state of Utah lawmakers did, a requirement that there are armed guards in every public school. A lot of people had a lot of feelings about this mandate. Schools say they want to do, most schools say they want to do the right thing, but the funding is a real struggle. The price tag, we estimate, could be up to $800 million to pay for these armed security guards in every school in the state of Utah. They're going to go back to the legislature and ask for more money next session, but the deadline for schools to complete the assessment to understand what they need to do and what it'll cost is December 31. So there's a lot of moving parts here, a lot of uncertainty. The state expects full compliance, but I'll be honest with you, I don't see a path to getting to that full compliance given the funding that's been allocated as of right now.
And then the other education story was Mike Schultz talking about state funding of higher education. What's he saying and how are the colleges going to deal with it?
Yeah, so last year, if you remember, the legislature had DEI programming in its crosshairs with respect to higher ed and really education institutions across the state. And it asked that, you know, DEI programs, you know, be disbanded, right? And that we include all as we look at, you know, how we're serving our students. This year, Mike Schultz has told the Tribune exclusively that he's interested in seeing the Utah's institutions of higher education, of which there are 16, fund 10% in savings. And, you know, I think everyone could tell you government spends a lot and maybe too much in some spaces and not enough in the other. So is this exercise helpful? Time will tell. But 10% is a not insignificant cut in the higher education space. No idea how we'll get there. Again, Schultz said maybe it's 10%, maybe it's more, maybe it's less. But he has essentially, you know, waved the flag and said this is something he's going to be looking at.
I'm trying to think of how, I mean, that, as you say, it's a not insignificant number. And if you think about the concept of a zero-sum game here, either they're going to have, for them to cut costs, either they would have to, I guess what they're saying is they're going to cut what the state's going to give them. Is he saying that they're going to cut what the state is going to give them by 10% mm-hmm. or that they're going to have to cut their spending by 10%? Because one possibility, obviously, would be to raise tuition.
Yes, absolutely. And that's a very sensitive issue, as you would imagine, too, right? You know, and as we look at the student population in Utah, I think each of the universities here has been loath to increase costs, right? And so, you know, he's asking for a 10% budget cut, and he would ask higher institutions to come up with that. Would the state's allocations be part of that? You know, again, time will tell. Last year, the state gave about $1.8 billion to higher education. Some of it could come from the state allocation. It could be, you know, that they find it elsewhere.
Thanks, Lauren. Appreciate talking to you.
Sure. Have a great day.
You too. Bye. You've been listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW.